Holy Spirit, would you just speak to our hearts and help us to understand, illuminate our hearts. Drive home your word to us this morning, that we would be the children, the people you have created and called us to be for your glory. We ask in Jesus' name, amen. So since January, we started at the beginning, right? Genesis 1:1, and we've been looking at God at work in the lives of real people that are living in real places in real time, that are real examples to us of what living life with the living God looks like. God and his work of redemption, what that looks like for us. And so this morning we are coming to the end of the book of Joshua, which means that we have made a huge leap forward in time from where we were two Sundays ago, which was Moses. And we have skipped past Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy and most of Joshua, and today we've landed at Joshua chapter 22. So to help us get a little bit of what all that was like, we have a short video to show you hopefully this morning, and this is great stuff. Andrew's been showing it to the young adults group on Thursday nights as they've been going through the Bible, and so this is just a great synopsis of the book of Joshua. So hang on to something, and here we go. Yeah.
God is the one who will deliver his people. Israel simply needs to trust and wait.
Now, the next story of the battle at Ai makes the opposite point. So there's this Israelite named Achan, and he steals from Jericho some of the devoted goods that were to belong to God alone, and then he lies about it. He lies about it.
Thank you.
Isn't that great? Yeah. It is obviously a ton of material to take in, which, by the way, in the back you got the message notes, right? And then right next to the message notes is the chart. So if you want to take one of those home with you, and there's also a URL on there for where you can actually look at that online as well. So great video. And so overall, the book of Joshua is Israel conquering and then dividing up the promised land, which is a real-life demonstration of two pretty basic takeaways. And the first one is this, that God always, always comes through on his promises. God is always worthy of our trust. And the second takeaway is this, and that is trust self and get creamed, right? Trust God and get victory, which is pretty basic for life, right? Yes, good. So what we're looking at the next few Sundays is what those takeaways look like in real life. In other words, as those who live by victory and the promises of Jesus, what can we learn about God's people back then that helps us to stay obediently living by faith with God today? So let's jump into the text, Joshua 22, starting at verse 1, which is Joshua's warning. Here we go. At that time, Joshua summoned the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh and said to them, "You have kept all that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, and have obeyed my voice and all that I have commanded you. You have not forsaken your brothers these many days down to this day, but have been careful to keep the charge of the Lord your God. And now the Lord your God has given rest to your brothers, as he promised them. Therefore turn and go to your tents in the land where your possession lies, which Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you on the other side of the Jordan. Only be very careful to observe the commandment and the law that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, to love the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, and keep his commandments, and to cling to him, and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul." So Joshua blessed them and sent them away, and they went to their tents. Now to the one half of the tribe of Manasseh, Moses had given a possession in Bashan, but to the other half, Joshua had given the possession beside their brothers in the land west of the Jordan. And when Joshua sent them away to their homes and blessed them, he said to them, "Go back to your tents with much wealth and with very much livestock, with silver, gold, bronze, iron, and with much clothing. Divide the spoil of your enemies with your brothers." So the people of Reuben and the people of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh returned home, parting from the people of Israel at Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan, to go to the land of Gilead, their own land, of which they had possessed themselves by command of the Lord through Moses. That's a lot, isn't it? Okay. So looking at the map, all right, here we go. Let's see if we can unpack that a little bit. Before God's people had entered the promised land, what was west of the Jordan River, before they crossed over the Jordan River, Israel had taken out the kingdoms of Sihon, Og, and the Midianites to the east of the Jordan River. You can see where the Jordan River is there to the east of that. They had taken all that out before they had crossed over the Jordan River to get to Jericho and the Battle of Jericho and all that. And so while the people of Israel were camped on the east side of the river, and they were waiting for God to take them over into the promised land, the tribes of Reuben and Gad saw that the land on the east side of the river, this is great land. It's good for grazing livestock. We got a pretty comfortable lifestyle going on over here. And so they came to Moses and they asked if they could just stay on the east side of the river. And so Moses, without consulting God, Moses strikes up this deal with the tribes of Reuben and Gad, and later on the half of the tribe of Manasseh, half because half the tribe stays on the east side of the river and the other half goes to the west side of the river, right? So Moses strikes this deal with the tribes. Fight with us now while we're over here conquering the promised land, and after we're all victorious, then you can come back and you can live on the east side of the river. So God's people, they went out and they conquered. This is Book of Joshua, right? They went over and they conquered the promised land in two separate campaigns. So first there's the southern campaign, which is in the south, right? Okay. Then they came back to the northern campaign, which was in the north, right? Okay. And then the warriors, while they were doing this, the warriors of those two and a half tribes, they fought alongside their brothers. They faithfully, with great bravery, with dedication, commitment, and sacrifice, they fulfilled 100% of their part of the deal. And so in coming to Joshua chapter 22, when it says at that time, meaning according to Moses' instructions, these warriors, they're commended by Joshua, job well done. They're cut loose to return to their families and their lands, which are on the east side of the Jordan River. And in Joshua chapter, in 22 verse 4, Joshua tells them, and now, the Lord your God has given you rest to your brothers, as he promised them. Therefore, turn and go to your tents in the land where your possession lies. And we need to be very careful with that verse. There's a lot of information in there. Because what Joshua is telling them at that point is a whole lot more than just about tents and land and possessions. Do you remember when Lot and Abraham had that conflict over their flocks? Remember that grazing of the flocks thing? Right? We looked at that in Genesis. Abraham told Lot, he said, well, you choose whatever land you want, and whatever's left over, then I'm going to take my flocks there. And so Lot looks at this Jordan River valley with all its water and prime grazing land. He says, yeah, I'll take that. Right? It's just like winning the lottery, pun intended. Right? And Abraham gets the leftovers. Lot's choice is based on selfish, not godly, but self-focused motivation, which we know ultimately didn't work out very well for Lot, right? Not good. Same choice here. Same motivation. Self, not God. Same consequences in the balance. God includes Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh in the same thing that he's promised in the other 9.5 tribes. He's got the whole promised land laid out for them. It's theirs. But Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh choose what is less than God's choice for them. Why? East side of the river, man. It looks like a really good deal for us. And in verse 4, Joshua says that God has given what to your brothers? Rest. I mean, and this is the sixth time, book of Joshua, this word rest is used. Every time it refers to the tribes on the west side of the Jordan, never to the east. That's huge. So the war is over. God's promised victory is won, but we know that there are going to be more battles fought. Rest isn't just about ending hostilities. Rest, in a deeper, more lasting, at the core of who we are, spiritual sense, rest comes when despite our circumstances, when we learn to trust God to leave our lives in His hands. Rest is something that only comes from God. So in verse 4, Joshua is saying that since God gave rest to your brothers that are west of the Jordan, now you can all go back to the east with all your possessions where there's no rest. The land, the wilderness, the east, it's your possession. It's a concession to a choice that you made. Moses, not God, gave it to you. It's an allowance that God permitted, but it really wasn't God's best, what He had for you. And on the west side of the Jordan, God gave us two. They got cities and houses and meaning stability. And instead, you possess tents. Tents have no foundation. They're transitory. They're restless. What we take on camping trips, right? What life is like when we're trusting ourselves and not God. There's a huge warning in that. There are two significant events in the Old Testament. They get referred to over and over and over and over and over again. And the first is deliverance from Egypt, right? And that whole going through the Red Sea, passing through the Red Sea, when God's people ceased from being slaves and became a nation. And the second significant event is the crossing of the Jordan, when God's people ceased from being wanderers and became possessors of God's promises. The crossing through the Jordan, from east to west, for God's people, that signifies that what people were eating, the Jordan, they esteemed God's provision in the land. They experienced His presence. They had watched Him bring victory. All of what we saw in that video. But now they have chosen to separate themselves to move back closer to the issues and the influences of godless people in what lay in the east. Which is a danger for us, right? And we can experience God's victory. We can see God do amazing things in our lives. We can know His presence with us. We can desire the blessing of being west of the Jordan, but we struggle to cross the river. And we struggle to let go of what we know, where we've been, where we're comfortable, and we can choose to turn back from totally trusting God. Joshua's dismissal includes the sobering thought, there is no rest east of the river, only tents. In verse 5, Joshua warns them. He says, be very careful. Be very careful to observe the commands that the law that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you to love the Lord your God and to walk in all His ways and keep His commandments and to cling to Him and to serve Him with all your heart and with all your soul. Be careful. In Hebrew, it's the word shamar, meaning keep your guard up. There's a very real and present danger here. Take intentional steps to keep focused on God, to stay 100% committed to God, or you are going to be in serious, serious trouble. Joshua's warning includes prophetic prescriptive advice. Observe what Moses commanded you. Don't stop loving and obeying and serving God with everything that you are. Same commandment that Jesus highlighted when he was asked, well, which commandment is the greatest commandment which applies to us today? You shall love the Lord your God with what? With all your heart and with all your soul, with all your mind. Keep your guard up. Obey God. Cling to God. Serve God with all that you are. Verse 10 brings us to the altar. To the altar. Verse 10. Here we go. And when they came to the region of the Jordan that is in the land of Canaan, the people of Reuben, the people of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh built there an altar by the Jordan, an altar of imposing size. The people of Israel heard it. It said, behold, the people of Reuben and the people of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh built an altar on the frontier of the land of Canaan, in the region about the Jordan, on the side that belongs to the people of Israel. And the people of Israel heard of it. The whole assembly of the people of Israel gathered at Shiloh to make war against them. So looking at the map, someplace east or someplace west of the Jordan River, the two and a half tribes decided to build an altar. They're on the way back to their land, decided to build this altar. Imposing size means that it was big enough to be seen from the east side of the river. Meaning, you know, it was probably, if it was built someplace along where that squiggly line is there, orange line is, they could see it east of the river. And Shiloh, verse 12, by the time that the land has been divided among the tribes, Shiloh has become the religious and political center of the nation. You can see where Shiloh is there. Shiloh is up in the mountains, up in the hills there. And it's where the tent of meeting was. It was where the Ark of the Covenant is there. And Shiloh is the place where God's people go to worship God. So think, if a group of creeksiders here, if they decide to put up a building across Bear Creek, as a place of worship, with comfy green, teal-colored chairs and killer sound system, maybe better AC, I don't know, the whole works. Wouldn't that raise some questions? Yeah? So point being, where they had built this huge altar was on the west side of the river, but it wasn't in Shiloh, and the nation is ready to go arms about it. They're up in arms about this thing. Which brings us to verse 13, which is the concern. Why is building this altar a reason to go to war, and people are going to get dead? Verse 13, then the people of Israel sent to the people of Reuben, the people of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, the land of Gilead. Phinehas, sent them Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest, and with him 10 chiefs, one from each of the tribal families of Israel. And every one of them, the head of the family, along with the clans of Israel, and they came to the people of Reuben, the people of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, in the land of Gilead, and they said to them, so to their credit, right, rather than charge down the hill, you know, wiping out everyone, in response to this altar being built, they sent a delegation down from Shiloh with Phinehas, who's the son of the priest Eleazar, the representative of the other tribes, and anyone else who wanted to come along for this thing. Verse 16, thus says the whole congregation of the Lord, what is this breach of faith that you have committed against the God of Israel and turning away this day from following the Lord by building yourselves an altar this day in rebellion against the Lord? Have we not had enough of the sin at Peor, of sin, the sin of Peor, from which even yet we have not cleansed ourselves, and for which there came a plague upon the congregation of the Lord, that you too must turn away this day from falling, Lord. And if you too rebel against the Lord today, then tomorrow he'll be angry with the whole congregation of Israel. Backstory. The sin of Peor goes back to when Israel got into fornication with the women of Moab, participating in their fertility rites and sexual immorality. They began making sacrifices to the Moabite god, specifically the Baal of Peor. And God sent a plague that wiped out about 24,000 Israelites. Okay, that's a lot. The deeper issues of that sin was something people in Joshua's day, they're still struggling with that. Stuff's still going on. Verse 19. But now, if the land of your possession is unclean, pass over into the Lord's land where the Lord's tabernacle stands and take for yourselves a possession among us. Only do not rebel against the Lord or make us as rebels by building for yourselves an altar other than the altar of the Lord our God. Did not Achan, or as some say, Achan, the son of Zerah, break faith in the matter of the devoted things, and wrath fell upon all the congregation of Israel, and he did not perish alone for his iniquity. So Achan and Zerah breaking faith goes back to when Israel, remember this, they defeated Jericho? And Achan kept things. He took and he hid them in his tent, kept things as God said, no, you need to destroy those things. So he hid those things. He acted privately in an act of disobedience against God. As a result, Israel was later defeated at Ai, and Achan and his family were stoned, and the stuff that they had was all burned. God's judgment on spiritual infidelity. So there's a real spiritual concern here. You know, what is this altar business? Have Reuben, Gad, Hashai, and Asher, they've gone off the deep end spiritually, like what happened at Peor or what Achan did? And if they have, we need to deal with this effectively, swiftly. Otherwise, verse 18, the whole nation's in trouble. You know, people say, well, you know, sin is a private thing, right? I mean, it's my own deal, but it isn't. Right? Sin is never solo. Personal sin always affects other people. The degree of our own individual commitment or lack of commitment to Christ and His church has an effect on all of us, on our families. Porn is an example of lust and mental fornication, sin. And aside from how porn messes us up mentally, emotionally, and spiritually, and how porn affects how we deal with our relationships with other people and God, those actors are part of a multi-billion-dollar international industry that abducts and enslaves small children and women and men, and that traffics and abuses and destroys and discards them. So, this, it's just my own private deal. Well, clicking on porn just contributes to that, whether you pay for it or not. So Peor's sin, the sin of Peor was public. And Achan's sin was private. And all that got thousands dead. Sin is never solo. And so this altar is a serious concern for the nation, for the tribes east of the Jordan River. An accusation is made. Verse 16. You've acted unfaithfully towards God. You've turned away from God. Deliberately rebelled against Him. And notice the accusations also come with an offer. Verse 19. You know, if you guys are really struggling about this, if this is a spiritual struggle for you, if because of what it's like on the east side of the Jordan River, you know, we can make space for you on the western side of the river. Join us. Just come back. Come. So if the delegation doesn't come back to Shiloh with sufficient answer, there is a nation ready to go to war to deal decisively with the sin. But with all that, the nation is also deeply concerned about the spiritual, the brother's spiritual condition. And so the purpose of this delegation is to express concern to ask questions and make an offer to do whatever it takes to help. Which is also a lesson for us. It was way too easy for us to do it. When we can tell you what the gospel is, we want to go to the Sin is never solo. Healing doesn't happen in isolation. We need each other for to be God's people. Verse 20 brings us to the answer. Here's the answer. Then the people of Reuben, the people of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh said in answer to the heads of the families of Israel, the mighty one, God, the Lord, the mighty one, God, the Lord, He knows. And let Israel itself know. If it was in rebellion or in a breach of faith against the Lord, do not spare us today for building an altar to turn away from following the Lord. Or if we did so to offer burnt offerings or grain offerings or peace offerings on it, may the Lord Himself take vengeance. Verse 24. No. But we did it from fear that in time to come your children might say to our children, you all east of the Jordan River, what have you to do with the Lord, the God of Israel? For the Lord has made the Jordan, a boundary between us and you, you people of Reuben, people of Gad, who have no portion in the Lord. So your children might make our children cease to worship the Lord. So the reason they built this altar was what? It's out of fear, right? We took this great step of faith and consecration and dedication to one mighty God out of great fear for the spiritual welfare of our children. You know, God put this boundary, the Jordan River, between us. We're concerned about what your children may tell our children and that future generations of Westsiders may cause the spiritual death of future Eastsiders. Okay, that sounds great, but let's think. God created the river. We get that. But who made the deal with Moses? Who chose to dwell in tents and all that grazing land east of the river? Gad, Reuben, and half of Manasseh. And their motivation, the spiritual warfare of the children, that sounds like a great thing. You know, we're being very obedient to God, but they're living in fear because they're trusting in themselves for that and not God. Verse 26, therefore, because of our great concern for the spiritual welfare of our children, and because you and God may mess up all of that, therefore, we said, let us now build an altar, not for burnt offering, not for sacrifice, but to be a witness between us and you, and between our generations after us, that we do perform the service of the Lord in His presence with our burnt offerings and sacrifices and peace offerings, so your children will not say to our children in time to come, you have no portion in the Lord. And we thought, if this should be said to us or to our descendants in time to come, we should say, behold, the copy of the altar of the Lord, which our fathers made, not the burnt offerings, nor the sacrifices, but to be the witness between us and you. Far be it from us that we should rebel against the Lord and turn away this day from following the Lord by building an altar for burning offering, grain offering, for a sacrifice, or other than the altar of the Lord our God that stands before His tabernacle. Meaning, this altar, it's a replica. This is a monument, right? It's made to look like the altar up in Shiloh, up in the mountains, which is before the tabernacle, and it can't be seen from the east side. A monument here that is built because they're afraid of being cut off from the nation of God and God's blessing them. Because the site is, after all, they're not rebelling against God. To stay on the eastern side of the river where it's comfortable. No matter how we may try to justify our actions, even dressing them up in spiritual platitudes, choices about giving and serving and what we choose to expose ourselves to and to participate in, the attitudes we harbor in our hearts, the thoughts we entertain, no matter how private, no matter how we choose to justify all that, we need to be reminded that sin is deceptive. And without God in control of our hearts, we're easily deceived. The whole nation of Israel is ready to go to war over this. It's that serious a spiritual danger. And out of great concern, they sent a delegation. They offered to help, giving up the land, giving up their land. But for Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh, there's no genuine accountability. There's no openness to counsel, only self-deception, self-justification, and accusation. Verse 30, the epilogue. How it all ends up. When Phinehas the priest and chief of the congregation, there's a lot of repetition in here, right? Yeah. Wait until he does. This is, we're listening to the Hebrew storytelling at its best here. It's Hebrew life account. When Phinehas, the priest, and the chiefs of the congregation, the heads of the families of Israel who were with him, heard the words that the people of Reuben, the people of Gad, and the people of Manasseh spoke, it was good in their eyes. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest, said to the people of Reuben, the people of Gad, and the people of Manasseh, today we know that the Lord is in our midst, because you have not committed this breach of faith against the Lord. Now you have delivered the people of Israel from the land of the Lord. Then Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest, and the chief returned from the people of Reuben, and the people of Gad, and the land of Gilead, to the land of Canaan, the people of Israel, and brought back word to them. Here's the answer. And the report was good in the eyes of the people of Israel, in their eyes. The people of Israel blessed God and spoke no more of making war against them to destroy the land where the people of Reuben, the people of Gad, were settled. The people of Reuben, the people of Gad, called the altar witness. For, they said, it is a witness between us that the Lord is God. Apparently, testimonial monuments are okay. Alternate altars are not. The answer was given enough that it satisfied this delegation that heads on back up to Shiloh. And the sad reality of this is they were right. You know, generations were at stake. Manasseh was divided. Imagine his tribe was divided. Imagine his family was divided in half. And there was ongoing fear, and there was division. And in this are the seeds of coming spiritual disaster. The 2.5 tribes that were the first on the east side of the river, they were first to slide into apostasy and rebellion against God. They were the first to get hauled off by Israel's enemies. Their choice to stay on the east side of the river, it was just the beginning of all of that. What might have been avoided if the delegation hadn't settled for this face value, it's good in our own eyes type of answer. What could have been prevented, we don't know. Processing all that. Cartoon. Good grief. 184 to nothing. I don't understand it. How can we lose when we're so sincere? Okay? Sincerity is no substitute for faith. A few years ago, I was having some issues with our computer, and I was at the point of trying the ultimate fix. You ever try this with a hammer? Okay. And at the time, I had bought an external hard drive, and I had copied everything from the computer's hard drive onto this external hard drive, the documents, the program files, the Windows operating system, everything. And my theory at that time, which seemed so amazingly brilliant that it actually impressed myself with it, my theory was that if the hard drive on the computer ever crashed, then all I had to do was transfer everything back from the external hard drive onto the computer's hard drive, and away I would go as if nothing had ever really happened, which didn't work. And as best as I understand this, every time you use Windows, the operating system, it remembers what you did, which means that changes are then made to the system files, sys files, and so while the system file on our computer was changing, was being updated, the system file on the external hard drive wasn't, which meant that we had the potential of two differing Windows systems trying to operate simultaneously on one hard drive. You know, it doesn't take Bill Gates to understand that one computer with two conflicting operating systems is in serious trouble. And when we try to live in the blessings and the promises and blessings of God, with one foot planted on the west side of the Jordan, and yet we're trying to keep our other foot planted on the east side of the Jordan, hanging on to our version of following God. It doesn't matter how sincere we may be in doing all kinds of things for God, building altars, whatever. Sincerity is no substitute for faith. And no matter what we may convince ourselves we may be doing for God, if we haven't crossed the river, listening to Joshua's warning to keep our guard up, obeying and clinging and serving God with all that we are in serious, serious trouble. And potentially, so are those around us. Two takeaway questions. First question, what keeps you on the east side of the river? What keeps you looking backward to where you've been, hanging on to what's keeping you from God's best for you? Is that really worth hanging on to? And the second is, what keeps you from crossing? And the best way to cross the river is to cross the river. That's intentional. It means there's a choice that needs to be made. It just comes down to a basic choice to cross, to give up all of that, giving all of that up to cross to what God offers you. And you just need to do it. Choose to cross. God is always worthy of our trust. Lessons of Joshua. Trust self, get creamed. Trust God, get victory. Let's bow together in prayer. Father, I appreciate so much that you've recorded this account for us of real people dealing with real issues. And we see some of the immediacy of it here in this account, and then we see later on in history the consequences of not dealing with sin, the consequences of trying to hang on to what we want to hang on to for our life. You know, trust self, get cream. Trust God, there's victory in that. And it is something. I think we all struggle sometimes. You know, we cross the river and we go back, or we have trouble stepping forward into that river. And yet, when we see what's on the west side, man, what God has for us is so much better. I mean, how is life on the east side going for you? How's the rest? The stability when you're doing it on your own. So I don't know. I mean, those are takeaway questions. You know, what it is that you're hanging on the east side, where the struggle is in crossing the river, but cross the river. And God, we cry out to you. Help us. Forgive us, because we don't cross. We see all of what you offer us. You know, you can lead us to the river, but you can't make us cross. And but God, please be patient with us. Help us to get across it. God, help us to see the danger of where we are apart from you, and to embrace, God, maybe this week, it's a choice you need to make. God, I'm going to choose to cross. I'm going to trust you with my life. Do it. Don't look back. Just keep going. Keep going. God, thank you for Joshua's warning. And so may we be on the guard and obey and cling to you with everything that we are, and to learn, God, to live with you on the west side of the river in your promises. We pray in Jesus' name.